This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
So, hello, and thank you for coming today to the National Museum of Australia. My name is Tanya Riviere. I'm by trade a paper conservator, and I work out in the conservation area of the museum here. I'm also your MC for today. So I would like to begin today by acknowledging the traditional owners of on the land of which we meet today. The journey of the objects and their life at the museum is the inspiration for our series of Door to Store, Caring for Your Collection. This workshop style program aims to teach the public about the work that our conservation area does and the curatorial and registration teams. Each session demonstrates the techniques for handling, storing and conserving our collection and offers practical examples that can be implemented at home. I'd like to welcome everyone here today, and I'd also like to extend a welcome to everyone who's tuning in live from Kiama.
Hello, this is Michael, Outreach Services Officer from Kiama Library. I'd like to thank for the welcome, and we're always glad to take part.
Fantastic, that's great. So today's topic is family history documents. These documents really help us understand where our families came from. But how do we find them? And once we've found them, what do we do with them and how do we best look after them so we can ensure that we have them to pass over to future generations? Some of these questions hopefully will be answered today and many more of your questions that you might have from our two speakers. And joining us today, we have family historian Jenny Higgins from the National Library of Australia, who's going to provide some great tips on how to find your documents and information. And then we'll talk to our paper conservator, Jess Wignall, who will share some of her knowledge and expertise on how to look after those documents once you've found them and how to keep them for your family and future generations. So I'd like to welcome Jenny to the floor.
Thank you very much for the welcome. We've all got them. My mother keeps some in an old book about dressmaking, documents of special interest to her, interleaved with pages about embroidery. She actually needs to come to this lecture. But the book is important too. My grandmother kept her treasures in this box. Even the box has a dedication inside it that helps with my family history. And here's a list of some of the items in Grandma's box. So you can see there's some very interesting things and some rather things that perhaps are not useful. Her parents' original marriage certificate was fabulous. Newspaper article about her husband's hooliganism. And various other things which to me didn't seem to be very connected to the family history in the first instance, or things that I didn't understand. Here's another, more of the list. It went on and on. This is only just an excerpt of some of the things that I found in Grandma's box. Any collection of treasured items in your family will help you with your family history, but where to start? What you need to do basically is start with paperwork. Starting from yourself, write down the names of ancestors you know and what you know about them, parents, then grandparents, and so on. A chart like this is very helpful, and I've put some on the table, and I notice that some of them, you have picked them up. So this chart is one where you can write down your name and then your parents' names, your grandparents' names, and write down those essential details about them, where they were born, when and where, and where they were married, and where they died, and the places for those events. And it gives you a very brief view of your ancestral lines and what you know and don't know. And I've always found when you start filling in one of these charts, you discover just how much you don't know. There's a second chart which I'd recommend is a family group sheet. And in this sheet is very information dense when you fill it in. And it gives you a view of one entire family. And it is very good for giving you a very quick look at a particular family. Both these charts are available via the ancestry.com website, which is available in our local libraries here and in other state libraries and in the National Library, and I'm sure it's available at the Kiama Library as well. And you can find other versions of this chart on the internet. It's a commonly used chart. There are two of them are very commonly used. Of course, you could also use an online service like Ancestry or Find My Past, but the paper versions help you get a broad view. And in point of fact, I use both. Now, go back to your artefacts. Note names, dates and places and types of events. So, for instance, my great-uncle's war service records helped me identify his name and what war he served in, and then I could go to the National Archives to look for his war service records. There was only actually just a few small documents about his war service in Grandma's box. Don't worry if there's no obvious connection. That's the exciting part of family history, when an artefact suddenly makes sense. My great-grandmother's job references made me look in New South Wales immigration records for her rival, rather than in Victoria, which is the place that I would have expected because she spent all of her life in Australia in Victoria, or so I thought. The reference also told me to look for her sister as well on the ship because the reference said that she and her sister had been in New South Wales until the time they were about to leave for Victoria. Her grandma's marriage certificate told me that her father was born in London, which turned out to be true, although Grandma stolidly maintained that he was born in Slindon in Sussex, where most of the family action took place. Next, talk to the rallies. Talk to family members about the items and what they know about the family in general. Items in your collection are a great conversation starter. Rather than asking, tell me all you know about whoever, an item, and you're just as likely to get a response of nothing. I know nothing about Great Uncle George. But when you produce an item, it's quite often sparks off a train of memory or helps them focus on a particular event. Give your interviewees the chance to tell you what they know. Don't overwhelm them with your knowledge. They might even give you that one little clue to spark more research. And old aunties are fabulous for dating photographs, recognising long gone faces and forgotten places. And also, I would like to say there, you need to go down that old aunties path and talking to the rallies many times, because as you increase your knowledge about the family, you'll probably have more questions to ask. And also, people quite often have a first interview and then go away and think about what they've talked about with you, and then they'll actually realise they know more than they thought they did. And also, the other piece of advice that I should say is don't delay these conversations, because I know how many times I've thought, if only Grandma was still here, I could ask about that, and I know that she'd know the answer. The next step I think that I'd like to advise is to get a good research guide. Despite what we might think from the TV ads, family history research is a research process like any other, and it's good to get the guidance of experts plus background information about the records that you will need to research to use. For Australian and British Isles research, I think you can't go past this book. Now, this book was actually published by the Heraldry and Genealogy Society of the ACT, but I don't get a commission for any of its sales. I just think it's one of the best books for Australian research. And it's up to date, easy to read, and details the research trail, provides lists of good websites and books for background reading. So you can buy it online, or from the Society, or from the National Library Bookshop, or consult it in a local library or the National Library Bookshop. So in the National Library, it's on the shelves in the family history area. There's also a wealth of books available for overseas research and research about particular subjects. In the National Library, we have quite a number in our family history research area, so you can just walk in and read them. And I'm sure that's the same for in some local libraries and at the Kiama Library. Or try your state library or your family history society library. Also, look for books and guides about particular areas of research, such as convicts and immigration. People have written some very good guides about particular subject areas. The internet has any amount of background information and guides to research. Try to use a reputable site such as a library, archives, or a Family History Society's website. So the next step, get the facts. Confirm your known events with official records or certificates. It's essential that your research proceeds from a basis of correct information. You may lose a lot of time and money if you don't. You may think that you know where your grandfather or grandmother came from or where they got married or how many kids they had, but it's very important to check those things that you think you know with the official documents. Family secrets can often be just that, secret, until you find the official record doesn't match the family story. Get certificates to confirm your grandma's birth and marriage, etc. Get grandpa's war service record and find a newspaper report on the accident that took great-uncle's life. Discover that great-grandfather wasn't a major at all in the war, but a lowly private. How many times have we heard of that, of the story of grandpa being a major and very important in the army, and it turns out he was a private like most other people? My own great-grandmother said she was 17 when she married, but she was actually only 14 and maintained that deception all her life. Official records helped me sort out just who she was, and it cost me a lot of money, I can tell you that, to find out that she... because I couldn't find a birth certificate until I finally discovered that she was a lot younger than she said. So, how to do this? Use birth, deaths and marriage indexes. Australian, English and Welsh indexes can be found in ancestry.com. But also, don't forget the BDM indexes offered online by some state registers and the others that are available on CD and microfiche from the National Library and from local libraries and some local libraries and also from family history libraries. You may find actually these are actually easier to use, giving greater searchability, have more details, and sometimes, quite often in fact, have fewer errors than ancestry.com. So I'm just going to show you a list of the area on the National Library's website called eResources, and you can see there that a number of the listings of the a number of the electronic sources that we have for birth, deaths and marriage indexes for the Australian states. Each state has their own indexes. So it's not all in one big block like Ancestry is, but sometimes that's an advantage for searching. Now, I'd like to show you this search because sometimes it's easy to think that a lovely online commercial family history service is going to provide you with the answer. But sometimes their answers, their indexes show less than what is actually freely available. So here's an example of a search on the South Australian Birth Index. On the left, you can see that there's actually only 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 items of information, and the year of registration is actually a year range rather than a precise date or a precise year. If you're to use the index, which was published by Digger, that are at the National Library and in other places, you'll see that you think you get about 12 different items of information, and you can see the wealth of detail there, an exact date, the name of the church, the ages and the marital status of the parties, etc., and the father's name. So it's always a good idea to use the source that's going to give you the most information quickly, I think. It's important to get certificates for discovered events. They supply greater detail than the index and may tell you that you're on the wrong track, or better still, give you some vital clues to the next step for research. Some state certificates will give you parents' names, dates of birth, or how long in the colony, and other vital clues which don't show in the indexes. Online family history services, national, state, and local libraries can also help you with other types of records such as immigration, convict records, cemetery transcriptions, occupational lists and descriptions, and books for background information about general and local history, published family histories, biographies, and war histories. For instance, if you have a railway employee, apart from their full service records in the respective state archives, They appear on lists in government gazettes every few years, which are available in the National Library and other libraries, giving you a potted history of their progress, or lack of it. In recent years, Australian family history researchers have become besotted, and that's the only word that I can use, about a particular major source of information for Australian people, that is, Trove digitised Australian historic newspapers. How many people have used Trove here? Well, how many haven't used Trove? Oh, good, I'm glad I can talk to someone about it then. It's a free online, fully searchable service and contains a growing collection of newspapers from all over Australia to 1954. In fact, within 3 years, all New South Wales newspapers to 1954 will be included in the service. The Australian Woman's Weekly is included to 1982, and our local Canberra Times is being added to 1995 as part of our centenary celebrations. All parts of the newspaper are included, and this is the best bit for family historians, and are searchable. And that includes personal notices, advertisements, sports results, photographs, and all news items. As an example of what you might find, I searched for my grandfather's cousin, Eileen Higgins. So there's actually the newspaper part of Trove. There's more parts to Trove, but I'm just highlighting newspapers today. And here's a result for my search for Eileen Higgins, who became a doctor in the early 1920s. Looking there is the results of the search. It gives me a number of items. That was with her full search with a middle name, but I also did other searches with just Dr. Eileen Higgins as well. And this is the full digitised version of the newspaper article that you can see. So I not only discovered her university exam results from year to year, mentions of her in various hospital-related activities and social functions, an advertisement she placed for home help, notification of setting up her practice in Collins Street, Melbourne, but I also discovered this report of a court action against her for running into another car. She was driving at 15 miles an hour and failed to sound her horn at the intersection. Now, it sounds like she might have been a bit of a tearaway, but the article does mention that she had her mother in the car, so maybe it was just accidental. But what a snapshot of a thoroughly modern young woman driving a car in those times. Trove should be searched for all family names you know. You may be pleasantly or unpleasantly surprised at what you might find. It does come with a buyer beware, because sometimes there's some very nasty surprises in the newspapers. The next step for your family history is to go local. Once you've built up a reasonable picture of your family, visit the area they lived. Absorb the local and social landscape and talk to the local and family history society. These organisations are great holders of local material, know old-timers who might help, and can add to your knowledge or debunk your favourite theory with a few local facts. Join a family history society in the area of your research. Plus, you might consider joining one close to where you live so that they can help you with their expert advice. We have an excellent society here, which I've already mentioned. And that brings me back to the family treasures. Revisit them from time to time. Your new knowledge of family events will give them greater significance and possibly allow you to draw more information from them. And to fit them into the family history, I can now interpret exactly the bars and stars on my grandmother's mother's badge and know that the funeral card, which had a name but I didn't know who it was, is her mother's cousin. And the other thing I'd like to end up with is, don't forget your own treasures too. Give your own descendants a head start and write down the story of your own documents and keepsakes. The badge in my collection that simply says MSA may feel some people think that I was an employee of the Malayan Singapore Airlines, but in point of fact is actually the membership badge of the Maths Students Association at a Melbourne University. And what of the badge of a rectangular pink football? I reckon that's going to challenge a few people. So is there any questions? Yes, there are a number of services. There's a free service called Papers Pass for New Zealand, so you just need to Google Papers Pass and you'll find it. That's an excellent service. Most of the... are you interested particularly in the British Isles? Yeah, there are a number of services for the British Isles, and mostly they're not free. But the National Library, for instance, if you're a registered member, which is easy to do, provides at-home access to those newspaper services. There's 19th century British newspapers, Illustrated London News, which is also includes news from the colonies, Irish newspaper archives, and a few others too that go a bit further back. If you want to, come and talk to me afterwards about that.
We might have questions.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Jenny. That was fantastic.
No worries.
Welcome Jess to the stage, our paper conservator here at the museum, and she'll be talking about how best to look after your collection and how to store it in your home and things to carry it around in so it keeps safe. Thanks, Jess.
Thanks, Tanya, and thanks, Jenny. So, my name's Jess Wignall and I am a paper conservator at the National Museum. You just have to bear with me because I'm a little bit nervous. So family history documents, as we've just heard from Jenny, are a wide range of items being, you know, letters, Bibles, documents, certificates, newspapers and newspaper clippings and other memorabilia. All paper-based items can be cared for in very similar ways. So when I talk about books or documents, you can apply these to, you know, almost anything. The longevity of your documents can be threatened by numerous factors. And we break these factors down to two different groups, being inherent and external factors. Inherent factors like yellowing and pages becoming brittle are often due to the physical makeup of your documents. Correct storage and handling can slow these down, but we're never going to be able to stop them. The external factors like your environmental conditions, pests, dust, light, mould, are a little bit easier to control. In the museum, we have we look after our environmental conditions and we maintain sort of 20 degrees with plus or minus 2 degrees and humidity at 50% plus or minus 5. But this is kind of a little bit difficult to achieve in your own home. But good storage isn't. So paper is an organic medium, which means it expands and contracts with humidity. This means that if you can avoid dramatic changes and fluctuations in humidity, you'll be on a pretty good track. But temperature has an inverse relationship. So if you're sort of maintaining one, you'll generally maintain the other. We're fairly lucky in Canberra though. We don't have high humidity, not like Queensland. Pests and mould outbreaks can tend to be related to poor storage environments. So, you know, just check for the cause before you react. Maintain good housekeeping and check your check your storage areas regularly. Anniversaries can be often a good time to check your collection. You know, if you're thinking about grandma's something or other, you can pick a birthday and have a look at it again. As we said earlier, you know, you can try and achieve good things in your own home. So if you're putting things on display, avoid direct sunlight because that will obviously fade your object. And if you're hanging things on a wall, try and look for internal walls rather than exterior walls. But if you are putting them on exterior walls, you know, just check behind them. So if there's any dew point, you can address that. So there are many, many different methods for storing your things at home. I've got a few things here today and, you know, you're most welcome to come up and have a look afterwards and we can talk about them a little bit more. But generally, you know, keep your objects off the floor, away from external walls, and the middle of your house is generally the most stable. Again, kind of stay away from roof cavities and your uninsulated garage, because, you know, that is where your fluctuation is just going to skyrocket. So over here, we've got a few things that we'll talk about today. In an ideal world, we'd have archival boxes with, you know, beautiful fitting lids. And if you can, if your budget allows, purchase archival acid-free boxes. When you have your items in a box, you can pack them out, pack your box out with other, you know, paper so that your items don't swim around, and then you can also fit a few more things into that box. We've also got here things like you can purchase 4 flat folders, which have various grooves in them. Sorry if you can see that. So you can sort of adjust to the size of your... These are great for books, and you can adjust for the height difference, or you can make your own. And on the web, there's lots and lots of different styles of little 4 flap folders that you can create, specific to your item. In these as well, you can interleave. So if you've got small, discrete collections that are of similar size, these little boxes are great, and then can also be packed into a bigger box and hidden away so that everything's together. And so it's good to maintain all of your collection together. I also recommend labelling your boxes. As you can see here, there's an area where you can clearly label your box so that if you've got it in your cupboard, you can identify what's there, and especially if you've got a few boxes and you want to go to Grandma's letter, you know which box it's in. We also really like view books for family history documents because, again, you can store them really easily. They're very easily to purchase and, you know, available from most of your just general stationery shops or art supply shops. They already come with plastic sleeves, and the advantage is that, again, you can keep everything together, but you can see it from both sides. If it's particularly fragile, you can slip a piece of paper in behind so that it will have a bit of extra support. We've got an example here where there's using photo corners. We've secured, you know, 2 items of a similar size into the view book. And this allows also that they're not going to slip around and knock against each other. And also that once you've got it attached to the view book, it means that it's not going to apply pressure onto the item you've got behind it, which means that, you know, you're going to make sure that nothing ever touches and damages each other. For individual items, you can also make or purchase very slim and flat folders, again, with the 4 flaps, just so that there's complete cover of your little object inside. Paper's really nice because it you can annotate on the front what it is so that you don't have to open it up. And if you've got a couple of these, you can, you know, pick the right one when you're going to show someone or you're going to look at it again. We have different types of view books, so that's one that you can purchase very sort of easily, readily. And then we have these other types of polypropylene or polyethylene folders. that also have a a slip cover that they can go into, and these ones you can add or subtract as many Mylar pockets as you need. And in here I've got some Mylar pockets and some polyethylene pockets. And again, we've secured with... Sorry, can you see that, Diego? We've secured with photo corners. And photo corners are your best friend. There are also you can purchase these Mylar pockets in varying sizes. So if you have something that's a little bit bigger or a little bit smaller, you can find ones that will cater to your needs. Here's one with two that slips in from the top. And this is also where you can see from behind. So please, come down and have a look and have a feel of these materials, because they do feel quite different and provide just a little bit different support. Talking a little bit about books, old Bibles, can be very fragile and they can be quite fat. So we at the museum make up our own book pillows. It's got bean bags in it, so you can hear them there. And we can fluff them up either side, so that what you're doing is you're supporting the spine in here. And as you're turning your pages, and you'll see that the book requires quite a lot of different support if you're to one side or if you're to the other side of the book. And so we're able to really, fluff up this side so that we can still view the book properly, but it's fully supported. And that's a really nice way to do it. And at home, if you don't have an old bean bag, you can use, two pillows, small pillows, inside a pillowcase that you can sort of butt together and sit your book in the middle. Or if you've got an old down pillow that you can fluff up, just like I've done there, that's a really good way to start as well. We also use handmade book supports, and you can see here, this is on a nice little triangle, and that's where it's probably for a hardcover book, but these book pillows will work for a hardcover as well. So, the other thing I was going to say was when you have books on a bookshelf, getting books off a bookshelf is not good to pull from the spine. When you're pulling them off, if you remove them and get your fingers around the book, you'll actually support it much better and you won't cause any damage to that top part of the book or any damage down the spine. So most of these things can be applied to lots of different types of, paper objects. And but if you've ever got a problem where you don't feel comfortable or, you're just a little bit unsure, it's probably time to seek a conservator. And the AICCM, which is the Australian Institute for Conservation of Cultural Materials, can direct you to a local conservator and one that will sort of specialise in the material that you've got. So, great. If you've got any questions, please don't hesitate to ask and come down and have a feel. Thank you.
Okay, if we could invite Jenny back to the stage. I think we're going to have questions now for Jenny and Jess. I think we're going to start off with the Visions Theatre first, and then we'll cross to Kiama. So we've got a microphone that will be roving around, and if I ask you just to speak clearly into the microphone if you have questions, we'll open the floor.
Thanks, that was really interesting. I was just wondering, Jess, if you could talk to us a little bit about handling and whether it's good to use gloves or not when you're handling paper objects.
Yes, Michelle. Gloves are one of these things that's quite debatable. Clean hands is first and foremost the way to go. If you have gloves, we do suggest to have powder-free and close-fitting gloves so that you don't, you know, cause any further damage by, you know, things pulling or catching. Generally, if you're handling photographs, always use gloves. They will just protect against your fingers, you know, etching into the emulsion of the photograph. The other thing that I didn't forget to mention was a nice way of turning over, you know, an object with the assistance of another piece of paper. So we've got a little postcard here, and very easily we can pop a piece of paper over the top, turn the whole thing over, remove the paper, and you've got, you know, the other side. It's just a very passive way and supportive way of turning something small over. Thanks, Michelle.
With the plastics, are there any plastics to avoid when you're putting paper under plastics? Because some instances, the plastic tends to grab the paper.
Yes, definitely. It's a good question. I was trying to talk about the things that we do use so that I didn't put into your head that PVC is very bad. So avoid polyvinyl chlorides. Always look for polyester, polyethylene, and archival quality is usually the way to go. Does that answer? Great, thanks.
You've partially answered. I was going to ask a question about the plastics too. So the folders, that purple one, is that just like the ones you get in Big W and all that?
Sure is.
Okay.
Yeah, sure is. A lot of these are being made you know, without PVC for these reasons that, you know, we know that these chlorines are very bad and these are readily available. So it's a really good option, cheap.
Thank you. And what about the box where you are? Where does one get those?
Again, these can be purchased from archival suppliers or conservation suppliers. So if you do a Google search, the AICCM, as I said before, the Australian Institute of Conservation for Cultural Materials, that will direct you to some archival suppliers. But you can also Google search, you know, conservation suppliers, acid-free or archival suppliers. And there's many different types of acid-free boxes in terms of shape and size. You know, you can find one that's specific to what you would look for. Yep.
Is there any danger to these items when you want to store them electronically? Is there any damage that can be done when you do that sort of thing?
What do you mean electronically? Oh, well, so if you're going to take a photo and...
If you're taking photos and putting them through those heat scanners and...
I would stay well away from laminating. Never laminate. The heat and the adhesive will go straight into your object and you'll never be able to get it out. And it will cause yellowing and all sorts of yucky things. So if you want to have, you know, a loose, you know, piece that you can pick up and, you know, move around other than inside your folder, I would tend to recommend a Mylar pocket. The Mylar is slightly more rigid than the polyethylene sleeves, and that will give you just a little bit of extra support for your object.
If you're concerned about the light that's coming through your scanner to your objects, you can put them in a Mylar sleeve,
yeah,
or in a plastic sleeve, and that will reduce some of the light that's hitting through. You just need to make sure that the image that results from that, you're happy with it. It's usually a short, sharp burst of light. So as long as you're not copying that one item over and over again, most items can usually handle that, including photographs. But if they're a particular colour photograph or a black and white one that's faded anyway, you might just want to do it once.
Yeah.
And you don't want to be putting things through automatic feeders because they can get caught on that.
Yeah. And then if you do want to make multiple copies, copy from your copy. Yeah.
Electronically storing them, I guess they CDs or DVDs, is there a shelf life on those? Or should we worry about them after a few years?
Yes, you should worry about them. It's not my area of expertise, but I think digital formats are rapidly changing and evolving. So backing up all of your electronic records, you know, onto various formats is probably, you know, the safest way to go. But I think there's a little bit of information that you can find on the web about, you know, digital formats and the way they become obsolete so quickly. So I'd have a little look there. Is that...?
Okay, I'm more interested in shelf life of the actual object, like the CD or the DVD.
Oh, yeah, the physical...
I've just heard that they die after a few years. And curious to know whether I should worry about some of the ones I have.
CDs, I would think so, yes. As I said, you know, plastics and that sort of CD formats are not my area of expertise. The sort of paper-based stuff is. So, I mean, I'm sure you could contact the ASCCM and talk to someone that's a little bit more up on that sort of stuff. Yeah.
Considering uploading them onto an external hard drive,
yeah,
as well, so you have your CD there, but you've also got them on an external hard drive that's, yeah, sitting separate from your PC, so, yeah. So is that all? Oh, we've got one more?
If you had ink or something on the paper, not like a traditional pencil or pen, should that affect how you store it? Like if you had, I don't know, a Japanese calligraphy or something?
Yeah. Not necessarily. Amazingly enough, the Japanese sort of calligraphy ink is extremely stable. It's sort of a carbon black ink. But if you are... You know, it is a good idea to interleave. So if you've got a stack of, you know, documents that have got beautiful writing on them, I would just interleave with either with a tissue, just an acid-free tissue, or archive text, which is a just an acid-free paper, and that will stop any transfer if anything was to happen. Yeah.
Just wondering about storing of items that are already perhaps damaged, thinking of foxed paper, for example. Do we need to do anything special to save that from becoming a problem?
I would make sure that you do have anything that's got sort of foxing or staining on it that you do interleave it, or keep it, you know, in a plastic sleeve that's separate from your other items. But there's nothing particularly that you need to do that's different as opposed to any of your other paper items with foxing. Foxing is something that's sort of already happened within the paper. It will slow down with having it in a box and keeping it away from light and fluctuations of temperature and humidity. But no, there's nothing specifically special to do with it. Does that answer your question? Good, thank you.
Do you have any questions for Jenny before we move over to Kiama? No? We might cross to Kiama now for some questions.
Could you give me an idea of the best way to store old photographs?
Again, with photographs, these small paper individual envelopes are a really good way of storing them by themselves and then stacking them in a box together. You can also store photographs in your view books, and there are specifically photograph pages that you can purchase. I'll just find one here. If they're reasonably small, or this has got a divider for four photographs, which is nice because if there are any inscriptions on the back, you can view them as well without having to handle them on an individual basis.
I just had a question as well. Since you're very much going to be storing like items with like items, as in all the photos together and things like that, do you have any suggestions on making a catalogue or an index?
I think that, you know, if you do have the capacity to catalogue your items, that's a really good idea. If you're having a number type system or whatever system you choose, using a very soft lead pencil to annotate that number on the back of your photograph. Never use pens to write on the backs of photograph or letters or any paper documents. It will go through and you'll see indentations. Or if you're using these sort of paper envelopes, you can write your number on the paper envelope, and that will, you know, avoid any damage to your photo. However, you know, it might be a good spot to, if you've got a box of photographs, that you write, you know, your index on the top of the box, possibly.
I just wanted to know about large or sort of not the usual sort of A4 kinds of things, your boxes and things mainly cope with just A4 type paper. What do you do if you have, for example, old certificates that are quite big, or, you know, sort of oversized pieces of paper for different things? What do you suggest with those?
Sure, yeah. With oversized pieces of paper or folios, certificates or posters, you can purchase boxes that are a lot bigger, and they can be also be shallow as well, so that you don't have to put something that's quite big into a deep box. I recommend, if you are carrying a larger piece and you've got your workspace that's clean and free from clutter, you carry it with the corners and place it down. But Mylar pockets and boxes are available in larger sizes. If you've got the luxury of having a plan drawer or a plan cabinet to store your larger things in, that's really fabulous. Otherwise, you can create sort of bigger folders as well.
Hello. I think we're done.
Okay, that's great. So thank you, Kiama, for your participation today. Thank you to the audience. I think have we got any more questions before we wrap up? Oh, one more.
This is for the lady who was dealing with the ancestry. I went contacted Brighton Cemetery, and there's a group called the Crematorians who do volunteer work. And I sent an email, and they sent me back the cemetery records about the births, the dates, the minister, occupation, and all really good information of five relatives who were buried there. I was just wondering, I don't know if you know this, but can we just go to the cemetery and freely look up records there ourselves? And if possible, yeah.
I think it would vary from cemetery to cemetery, but there are a lot of cemeteries now have their burial registers online. Are you talking Brighton, Victoria or South Australia?
No, Brighton, Victoria.
I've been watching the Brighton, Victoria cemetery website for some time because they keep on promising the whole lot's going to come up, don't they? You can certainly go and visit the gravestones at any time, but the burial registers do vary. The best thing to do is to contact the cemetery itself and ask them that, okay. I think.
Yeah, good. Yeah. Thank you.
Mm.
Yeah. So.
Okay. I think before we finish up for the day, we would like to thank Jenny and Jess once again for today. It's been fantastic. Some lots of really good information there for you all to go on and look through your family history, and then you can store them properly. Thanks again to Kiama for getting on board, and we look forward to seeing you next time. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.